Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Lithium, the lightest metal on Earth, is a key element in the effort to combat climate change. Since lithium-ion batteries are far lighter than other batteries and hold a charge for much longer, they're an important component of solar and wind energy systems, storing energy for times when the sun doesn't shine or the wind isn't blowing. But while lithium is key to our renewable future, it is also a mineral that must be mined, and that can cause a whole slew of environmental problems. Today, we talk with Klamath Modoc artist and activist Kaila Farrell-Smith and Fort McDermitt Paiute tribal member Duranda Hickey about a controversial lithium mine proposed along the Oregon-Nevada border near the Fort McDermitt Paiute Shoshone Tribes Reservation. Kaila and Duranda, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having us back.
So this is a very challenging conversation we're going to have today. We were talking offline before we started this actual recording about the challenges for the environmental movement to face some of the consequences of extracting the lithium that's in our ubiquitous lithium batteries that we use for just about everything, and in particular that are going to be the cornerstone of a renewable future. So before we get into the specifics of lithium mining, I just wanted to have both of you kind of set up the conundrum as you see it. Why are you concerned about lithium mining, and what does it say about how we need to think about the future that we're heading to? And we'll start with Kaila.
Thanks, Barbara. It's great to be back on Locus Focus on KBOO today. I am extremely concerned. I guess I can speak from a personal place, and it's a very, very personal and spiritual place, which drew me to this lithium mining that's happening in Southern Oregon and Northern Nevada. This is, you know, Northern Paiute and Western Shoshone ancestral homelands and a deeply powerful spiritual place. And these are burial grounds, these are massacre sites. My father, the late Alfred Leo Smith, his court case, Al Smith versus the state of Oregon, you know, was a Supreme Court case that he was fighting when I was about 7 or 8 years old as a small child. So I traveled to D.C. with him fighting that case. And it was about Native American freedom of religion. It's an imprint. It's a very powerful memory, powerful memories. And so I would travel every single summer to Fort McDermitt for ceremony, for Sundance. And I know that they would participate in the Native American church ceremony, which is what my father participated in when he was fired from his job as an alcohol and drug counselor here in Southern Oregon. And so that was the case that you know, went forward all the way to Washington, D.C. So when I heard about what was happening at Thacker Pass, I mean, it hit me almost like a punch to the gut. Like, it was just like, no, like, this can't happen. I have to do everything and anything I can to stop the desecration of the sacred. A family member, Dean Barlise, who I've known my entire life, put a prayer call out. And so I traveled personally by myself to visit Thacker Pass and go visit this place. And they started singing the round dances and the ghost dance. And, you know, I grew up in ceremony and understand the history of the ghost dance. A lot of my research is about the ghost dance right now, currently, including my current painting. I'll just say that, you know, when I was in my 20s, I traveled a lot. And one of the places that I traveled to was through South America. And I visited Bolivia, in Evo Morales's Bolivia. And I say that there's only 3 times I've ever been in, like, really decolonized places in my life. One of them was at ceremony growing up with my father at Fort McDermitt Paiute here in Oregon. When I went to Bolivia, and Evo Morales' Bolivia, and then when I went to Standing Rock and worked there at the art tent. So those are, like, the 3 very powerful places that I've experienced complete indigenous communities and the power of that, and the power of community, and the power of prayer, and the prayer of youth. And so that's where I want to pass it on. And I'm just so excited to be on this conversation with you, Duranda.
Welcome, Duranda. And I want you to talk about where you're from, where you live, and what's going on your land.
Yeah, my name is Duranda Hinkey. I'm 23 years old. I'm from the Fort McDermitt Paiute and Shoshone tribe on the Northern Nevada and Southwest Oregon border. I'm also a part of the Atsak Kudakwa Wid Nuwut, or People of Red Mountain Committee. We joined together in order to stop or halt the Thacker Pass lithium mine, as well as look at other mines around our area who are threatening our tribal resources, you know, our tribal culture, and to stand up for, you know, the Mother Earth and like how all our beliefs go back to, you know, the earth. And so that's why we put that committee together. And so I'm residing on the reservation. And I also have been camping out at the protest camp, or I would like to say it as a protect camp, you know. That's what's going on. There is a the open pit lithium mine at this Thacker Pass, or better known as Pihimaha. In Paiute, that means rotten moon. And so we like to use that Indian name, just because there is a story behind it. There is knowledge in that place. There are first foods, you know, more of a ancestral homelands, because it is BLM land, but, you know, it's still our land that still, you know, has knowledge behind it. And so it is threatened by a lithium mine that's going to be 400 feet deep, about 17,000 square acres. And there's going to be 1.7 billion gallons of water used per year once the mine is in full operation. And then on top of that, there will be incinerators burning sulfuric acid to leach the lithium out of the clay each day for 24 hours. And so we see a contamination of land, air, and water. And yeah, it's not if the water is going to get contaminated, it's going to be when. And so, you know, that's why this place is so important. We're the Quinn River Valley, the Kings River Valley, the Fort McDermitt Paiute Shoshone Tribe, they're all being used as a sacrifice zone. And so we see this happening.
Tell us exactly where is the reservation?
Yeah, this reservation is on Northern Nevada border and the Southwest Oregon border. It is about 1 hour away from Winnemucca, Nevada, and then it is about 3 hours away from Boise, Idaho, and about 3 hours away from Reno, Nevada. So it is, you know, in this very isolated area. There's no light pollution. It's really beautiful. You know, there's small creeks. It's a high desert ecosystem.
I just wanted to get a sense of what the landscape looks like. Can you describe the feel of it and what it looks like?
Yeah, so when I'm up at Pihimaha or Thacker Pass, what I see are two mountainsides, one called the Double H Mountains and then the other called the Montana Mountains. And you see this like crescent-shaped valley, and that's how Pihimaha actually got its name, is because it looks like a crescent moon. And then you see this green sagebrush all over this mountainside. And you see wildflowers in the spring, you see the snow in the winter. It has really extreme weather. There's rain, there's snow, there's heat, there's wind. When you're up there, it's so windy that you think like, man, if there really is a lithium mine up here, it's gonna bring all that dust, everything that they're bringing up, everything that they're burning to these areas, to these rural and tribal communities. But then on the other side, you know, you see these wildlife, you know, crawling through the sagebrush, and these little dens of rabbits and little rats and mice and all of that. And you see the big game. There's antelope, there's sage hens, sage grouse, antelope, and those kinds of things. So it's a very beautiful place. At nighttime, you can see the whole Milky Way from mountainside to mountainside, and it's like one of the most beautiful things I probably have ever seen. And so this place is really bountiful with life. It's just that it's being threatened by this lithium mine.
Kalila mentioned it being a sacrifice zone. I wanted to get a sense of what that means to you and who is doing the sacrificing and who is being sacrificed.
Yeah, so we are considered this sacrifice zone for, I guess, the better good for this non-renewable energy push.
You mean renewable energy, right?
Yes, renewable energy, excuse me. And so I see us being sacrificed not only by, you know, the BLM, but, you know, they're the government. You know, the government, the global Lithium Nevada, everything. And to me, that is just so scary to think about, that, you know, there's this continuous genocide of indigenous peoples, of indigenous lands. And to me, that's really threatening, because what's going to happen to the next couple generations down the line? Pihimaha, if lithium mine goes through, it's not going to be Pihimaha anymore. It's not going to have that story. It's not going to have those spirits in that soil, you know? And so to me, it's really threatening. Again, it's another form of genocide.
Kahila, can you talk a little bit about these companies that are coming in and who they are?
What we're looking at is Lithium Americas, which completely stripped and destroyed water of indigenous peoples in Chile. And I think it's up in the Atacama Desert, so close to Bolivia. We saw the U.S. trying to do, not trying, it's very much attempted and it worked, a coup in Bolivia so that we could get the lithium in Bolivia. I believe now that their elections went through and they got that woman, I can't remember her name right now, but she's in prison now for murdering people in Bolivia for standing up against the coup. So this is what...
Can you just back up a little bit? This is interesting to me. Can you just kind of just give us a little bit of background about who Evo Morales was and why the United States wanted to get rid of him?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know all the details. Like I said, I traveled through there. I think we were like there in like 2008. It was one of those incredible places, like I was describing earlier, of this like kind of decolonized, indigenous-led a nation, a country. And it was so powerful. It was the first time where there was just indigenous women everywhere with their big, beautiful hats and beautiful, you know, fabrics and their babies in their backs. And they were just working. They had, you know, all their coca leaves. And I traveled through. And that was Evo Morales's Bolivia. But ultimately, what happened is that, you know, they completely, like, socialized their natural resource extraction, and the wealth gap changed very rapidly in that time and benefited the people. And so what we're seeing right now in the United States is we are turning into a Brazil. The rich are getting richer and richer and richer, and the poor are getting poorer and poorer. So the threat of social, you know, social democracies or whatever is a threat to the West and Western empire. And I mean, I don't know all the details of it. All I know is that Elon Musk made a tweet or whatever and said, we'll coup whoever we want. He really wanted the lithium for his Teslas. So, you know, it's all, when it comes to capitalism, it all comes to for profit. That is what capitalism, that is what it is. I can't see any equitable, sustainable future with renewable, I'm doing air quotes when I say that, renewable energy through capitalism in a for-profit system. So if there's somebody making a profit off of it, then it's not, you know, then there's going to be a sacrifice zone. Unfortunately, though, elected officials and judges and the people at Bureau of Land Management in Nevada they just push these things through. So it's, I don't know if it's the good old boy system. I mean, that's what we're dealing with down here in Klamath with the water wars. You know, I'm like, how are all of these farmers and irrigators just breaking the Clean Water Act law all the time, and everybody just lets it go through? If it's just this good old boy system, then that's I think what we're seeing in Nevada, where these judges are just passing through, the Bureau of Land Management is just passing through these permits. So it's not like an indigenous leader that they have to go through and coup. They already have their people in place. Lithium Nevada is the company. They are Canadian owned, so we just fought off Jordan Cove, Pembina, an LNG fossil fuel pipeline here in Southern Oregon, Canadian corporation, Lithium Nevada, Canadian corporation. We're all seeing what's going on in Canada right now with they're finding mass graves within the residential schools. So that's the other part of this that I want to bring this home to, is that this was a massacre. That's where this name comes from. These are our ancestors in the ground, what are they digging up? This is not okay. And anybody in Portland and Eugene and Oregon that thinks that they're just going to get their Tesla cars or their, you know, solar panels and they're all going to be good, no, that's not what's happening. And so we need to be really clear about what's happening at Thacker Pass. And so Lithium Nevada is the corporation. The other one that we're looking at, and this is Jindalee, which is a corporation on the Oregon side. So when I mentioned Disaster Peak, I'm just here as a watchdog, as a, you know, as the activist that I am, that I want to make sure that they do not give any permits to the Jindalee Corporation on the Oregon side. And I do not want to see, because this was, they snuck this through the pandemic, didn't get any consultation with indigenous communities, the Fort McDermott, Northern Paiute, or Western Shoshone tribes. That is horrendous. That is illegal, at least in the court of public opinion, in my opinion. So I want to make sure that they do not get any of the permits for the Oregon side at Disaster Peak, and that is the Jindalee Corporation. They're calling it the McDermott Projects.
And Jindalee is actually an Australian company.
Australian, yeah. So all the settler colonial nation states that are trying to loot all of the sacred.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today, we're talking with Klamath Modoc artist and activist Keila Farrell-Smith and McDermott Paiute tribal member Duranda Hinke about a controversial lithium mine proposed along the Oregon-Nevada border. Maybe I should correct that to be maybe more than two lithium mines being proposed. Let's talk about Jindaloo for a little bit of a moment. Who is this company and what are their plans?
So as much as I know, it's Jindaloo Resources Limited, and it's the McDermott Lithium Mine that they have exploration sites to. I actually was able to go and visit that exploration site, and it is just so eye-opening to think that, you know, the sage grouse isn't saving this, because 98% of the greater sage grouse is in, it's gone. The 2% left is in these northern Nevada, southwest Oregon areas, and they're just going to go in and have these lithium mines destroy it. And so we see this, again, the mass extinction. Back to Jindaloo Resources, I've gone on their website. I've looked at their exploration sites. I see, like, their maps, and right now, I believe they are going to try to start permitting. And so what the People of Red Mountain Committee has been trying to do is try to write letters to that county's BLM. It's different from Winnemucca BLM, who we have been trying to send emails to, letters to, ask for a consulting position in these meetings. But then we want to also look into this Oregon side, because you know, they haven't gone through those permits yet. We want to be able to stop it before, you know, it's like gone through all the permits with Thacker Pass already. The ROD, the EIS has all been approved. And so we're fighting this uphill battle. But with this Jindaloo Resources Limited project, we're able to, you know, start from the bottom. And I'm so glad to have Keila on this call and, you know, working with us, being like that watchdog. And so that's really important. Thank you.
So Keila, what are you doing from the Oregon side, both for McDermott and for the existing proposed lithium mine on the Nevada side?
At this point right now, thank you so much, Duranda, for being so concise and specific on the details of the Jindaloo project and where it's at right now. So I'm just inquiring with people I know, whether it's through Rogue Climate, which I'm a board member of, and I asked Rogue Climate, you know, where do you stand on this lithium mining issue? They are stating that they, if it is affecting and directly negatively impacting an indigenous community or communities of color, that they will be against it. With the Jindaloo Corporation, which is an Australian-owned corporation, we are just keeping an eye on the progress of them attempting to get permits. And at this point, I believe it's through the local Bureau of Land Management that that they're searching to get permits to do any work on starting to extract the lithium from the Oregon side, on the Oregon side of the disaster peak. So I'm just kind of like, you know, asking questions and getting a hold of folks who might be aware of this Jindaloo Corporation attempting to start to extract this even larger lithium deposit on the Oregon side.
Duranda, I want to go back to the lithium mine that has already just almost been approved, or maybe, has it actually been fully approved yet?
It is waiting on air and water quality permits from Nevada Division of Environmental Protection. Then it's also waiting on Eagle Take permits for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
So I wanted to talk about the whole process. When did people first find out about it?
I think it really depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to the Pass Tribal Council, they're the ones to, you know, approve it. But I think there was some kind of miscommunication, some things that were going on with our Pass Tribal government, to the point where, you know, they weren't letting tribal members know about things that were going on. And so we see that. However, you know, there was exploration of Thacker Pass back in like 2011, I believe. But if, you know, we look at the time on that, I was, what, maybe 12 years old. So I wasn't really thinking about lithium, you know. And so definitely depends on who you're talking to. But since we learned about Thacker Pass lithium mine, I personally found out about the EIS being approved, the record of decision being approved, back in February, the very end of February. I think it was like February 28th. And then that's the next couple of days, I actually went up to the Protect camp of Protect Thacker Pass. And so I read a High Country News article, and it actually stated that some of our tribal council members and our tribal chairwoman was, you know, looking at the mine, or was already kind of in favor almost of the mine. So that was like, whoa, let's step back a few steps. You know, I went to school for environmental science and policy. And so to me, I was like, oh my gosh, like, what did we do? Why was I not informed about this? Why did no one even speak about, you know, a lithium mine being close to the reservation? And so to me, I had to do a lot of like education, a lot of research myself. And in school, they didn't really teach me like, hey, lithium, you know, isn't as good as what we think it is, you know? Yes, it is renewable energy, but where are all those things coming from? You know, what indigenous lands are we destroying, and what resources, you know, natural resources are we taking from, you know, the land? So that's where it all started. And since then we've grown, we've had a pretty large, I guess, turnover rate of people like kind of for the mine, because they heard about jobs, they heard about money, you know, it was this like big old happy thing until they realized like, hey, this is going to threaten us as, you know, as a people, as tribal resources, and all the good things. Like, you know, there is going to be light pollution, there is going to be contamination of the water and the air. And so it also disturbs hunting grounds for us when we go and get deer or antelope or whatever, you know, people are hunting for. So
is there a growing opposition amongst the tribes, or are you pretty divided still about whether the mine should be built or not?
Yeah, so in the beginning, it was more of like, hey, what is a lithium mine? What's going to be done? Blah, blah, blah. But since then, there has been this growing opposition, and you can start feeling it once you go into all the events that we're trying to put on to bring awareness, to bring the prayer back onto these lands. And so we've also felt a lot of other sister tribes or other indigenous tribes in our area start to ask like, hey, what can we do? Or waiting for our tribal council to invite them to this area. And so you know, we're kind of just taking as much as we can in, and it seems as if there's more tribal members wanting to be involved more, so that's really good. And as a committee, the People of Red Mountain Committee, we have about 12 members of that committee. And everyone, you know, from a youth to the, you know, middle age to elders. And then also we're starting to work on a youth council for this People of Red Mountain, which I think is really awesome. And it's important because the youth should have as strong of a voice as they should, you know, as, you know, the elders. And because that is who we're doing this for. And so I think that's pretty special.
In the work that I've done, I've become very aware of how natural resource extraction often divides tribes. And going back to, I was working on damming issues, river damming, back a number of years ago, and spent some time around the Animas La Plata proposed dam, which finally was built. And it was actually really divided the Southern Ute tribe. The tribal council was in support of it, but then there were all these other people that were not in support of it, who temporarily defeated it. And the same thing was true about nuclear waste repository that was being proposed for on tribal land in western Utah. And I don't think that ever actually went through. Why do you think it is that the tribes can be divided in this way by natural resource questions?
I would just like to say, you know, I don't ever want to bash a tribal council person in general, but, you know, there is starting to feel like there's a disconnection between the tribal council and the tribal members. And I really wish, you know, there was transparency in that. But I do want to say that there is trauma within tribal communities. And sometimes we bring that trauma into tribal councils. And, you know, as being tribal members, we've always seen like this miscommunication. So we're worried that, you know, hey, they're not gonna listen to us, they're not gonna do this. And so I'm not sure why, but I really want to say it's just of the historical trauma that happens with tribal communities. You know, for the most part, tribal communities are very poor. And so when we see, like, say, COVID money come through, we want to see that, like, dispersed equally through everybody and not being, like, put in the general fund or things like that. And so With tribal resources, I think that we see, you know, that funding, that money that's going to come in, those jobs. But to me, that seems, yes, we do need those jobs, but not with mining, not in that way. I definitely think we can look into other jobs like environmental jobs, you know, restoring those rivers, restoring those first foods, maybe some kind of education and cultural jobs in there. And so, yeah, that's a really good question. I don't have like the full answer, but those are just some things to ponder on.
Well, one of the things that really struck me around the Jordan Cove fight was how unified the Klamath Modoc tribes were. I wonder if you can talk about that, Ke'ila, and why there was that uniformity, and if that's something that can build for future struggles.
Yeah, it's a tough question. I just personally see it as legacies of colonialism and assimilation. So when tribes are already working within a colonial system, for me personally, it was like what Durando was speaking to. I think at some point, you know, people are like, oh, there's jobs, and that's great, and we need them. We need jobs. We need opportunities, economic opportunities in really rural, poor communities. And, you know, that was the whole selling point of the Jordan Cove LNG projects, is that they were going to bring jobs to not only the Klamath tribes, but I mean, this is, we're talking about Klamath Falls, Malin, I mean, then all the wild rivers, right, from 500 waterways that the pipeline would have crossed through into Coos Bay. And so I think they really pushed it harder in Coos Bay as a selling point. I mean, that corporation, Canadian corporation, was spending $10 million a month on propaganda, on pamphlets, you know, that, I mean, we were getting mailings that looked like REI advertisements in the mail talking about how great Jordan Cove is and like people camping on the water. And it was just a whole scam, you know, it's a corporate scam. So for me personally, and I think I could say for other Klamath tribal members, we had gone to Standing Rock. So, you know, that's like the warrior call, you know, like there was women that said, you know, you need to like stand up to your warrior spirit and show up because we got to stop this thing. And so that spoke to me. I was raised going to Sundances, so in that Sioux Lakota culture, and you know, for me it was a real thing. And so I had to go and put my prayers down at Oshete Shakoan, you know, at the sacred fires there, and ultimately I met some of my Samiks. The Samiks in Klamath is my relatives, my family, and you know, we knew, we were like, we have to stop a pipeline in Oregon. And so we went to Standing Rock in the spirit of that we're going to have to put our prayers down for to protect our homelands. So it's kind of that ancient call of like when you need to show up. And so for me, that's how I went. I think some other Klamath tribal members went, and some of the elders from the Klamath tribe went. When I was there was 10,000 people, you know, and so as an experience, like I was expressing earlier, you know, I've experienced that at ceremonies when I traveled through Bolivia, and then when I went to Standing Rock. It's a powerful thing. It's what being Indian is about. You know, as an Indigenous person, being a tribal person, you know, you go, whether it was from Alcatraz, that's where my father, you know, made the call to go to Alcatraz, or to Wounded Knee. I have aunties that, you know, and I have, you know, cousins that grew up in camp at Wounded Knee, at the second Wounded Knee. You know, I think places, and I don't know what that link is, whether, you know, Bolivia has that lithium, it's sacred, and those are sacred places to those people, to the Quechua people, the Aymara people in Bolivia. And when I've traveled through northern Nevada and southern Oregon, it reminds me very, very much of the Atacama Desert in Chile and in Bolivia. And so those sacred places, are those, you know, minerals that they want, is that the sacred, you know, is that what connects us to song and spirit, what people are doing to go to protect the sacred.
And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Klamath Modoc artist and activist Ke'ila Farrell-Smith and Fort McDermitt Paiute tribal member Durando Hinkey about controversial lithium mines that are being proposed along the Oregon-Nevada border. I wanted to follow up first, Ke'ila, on something you said earlier about there being ghost dances that were going on at the site where the mine is being proposed. And I think a lot of listeners probably don't know what ghost dances are. So why don't you describe what that is, and what is this? Actually, I don't know, Durando, would you like to talk about this? Because you're shaking your head.
I'll just jump in for a sec, but then I'll let Ke'ila take it. But ghost dance, you know, it was a prophecy from a Paiute elder I'm not sure what year, but it was back when, you know, they were trying to like put us on reservations, and there was a call out that this dance was going to heal us, to take away all that bad stuff. And so that's as really as far as I know. But every single time that, you know, we're at one of these ghost dance or round dance or these healing dances, the spirit there is so strong. You know, you're holding people's hands and you're dancing and you hear that drum beat, and in your mind, you know, you're having those good prayers, you're having those good thoughts, and it's such a like camaraderie feeling that, you know, we're standing here together praying for this place. And so every single time that we've had these events at Pihimaha or Thacker Pass, it has felt so strong. I've always came back with like a really good feeling. So I'll let Kaila take away more of like the history behind it.
That's so beautiful, Duranda. Thank you for expressing yourself and the power of what a place can exude or bring out in you. And I'm a wilderness first responder. I've led a lot of hiking, kayaking, backpacking trips, and what I say is that the land can heal you and will heal you if you let it, and if you engage and participate with the land in that way. And I think that goes across communities, but the place where I've known and learned that most closely was through connections with my indigenous communities and participating in ceremony. So growing up, I learned about the ghost dance from many elders and many Klamath Modoc elders, but also a lot of the Lakota medicine men who came to Oregon. And so I was raised, you know, going to Sundance ceremonies with my father, the late Alfred Leo Smith. And the Sundance came to Oregon because it was like answering an old prayer, because the Paiute and its Wovoka, so there was the ghost dances of the late 1870s, which is where the Modocs danced during the Modoc War. So if you go to the lava beds, there's the ring, and it's still right there in the ground, and that's where the Modocs danced the ghost dance. And so they called it the call. So if you hear indigenous people sing, especially at ceremonies, it's like a call, it's a calling. I think of it like the blues. You know, it's like this deep place, it's the call, but they call it the call. And so that's kind of the original ghost dance. But then Wovoka, who's the Paiute elder, who was a very deep spiritual person, and they say that they could call the storms and the weather and bring rain or snow at will. That's the ghost dance of the 1890s, which is the one that spread to, I think it's 23 different indigenous communities. And it was spread via the Iron Horse, the very controversial Iron Horse. So the Iron Horse is the trains. So, you know, the trains are being built coming out west. The Sioux are fighting the trains. But then the trains make it all the way out here. That's spreading, you know, manifest destiny, the westward expansionism, all of these terms that we are now just are like a part of U.S. history. But, you know, indigenous people were fighting back against all of this colonialism and genocide and everything. But as I write, you know, I'm writing my manuscript right now, and I write about the ghost dance. What I find so intriguing is the survivance, that word survivance. Gerald Weisner, I think coined it, and it's like survival. It's not just surviving, but it's surviving in life and thriving. And indigenous people on the Paiute side, you know, when the Iron Horse got to Oregon, they ended up realizing that they could travel to all these other indigenous communities and visit each other. And so Indian people actually like loved riding the trains. And so the ghost dance traveled all the way. And so it traveled all the way out even to Lakota Sioux and Wounded Knee, you know. And so Wounded Knee, I mean, ultimately, you know, the Modocs were lynched. You know, I don't know if it was specifically for dancing the ghost dance, but they wouldn't go onto the Klamath Reservation, so that was the Modoc War. The Wounded Knee, they were massacred for dancing the ghost dance. So just the act of like indigenous people dancing the ghost dance, we were murdered for it, and we were annihilated and assassinated for it. So the power of the history of what this dance is, and you know, it's about the prayer that our ancestors will come back to this land, and that we will have that healing. So for me, it was really powerful to know. I've heard my elders talk for years that the ghost dance is coming back. And so when I first heard that my ancestor or my Samix, I don't know how I'll call people, Dean, was going to be, you know, dance or singing the ghost dance songs up at Thacker Pass, it was so powerful. I was like, I have to go be there when that was initiated. And it really is a powerful, powerful experience.
Well, Kayla, I want to go back to South America again for a little bit and talk about the lithium mines in Bolivia and northern Chile. You talk about how it's been an area that's been decolonized by indigenous people, but I'm wondering what impact have those lithium mines had on indigenous land, both in Bolivia and in Chile?
That's a tricky conversation because they're calling it the White Gold Rush, right? And so it was called that down in South America. And those, you know, many, many indigenous communities have been decimated in that their water sources are polluted and they can't come back. And that's the biggest concern for the Northern Paiute and Western Shoshone in regards to this specific lithium mine. And what's scary, so here, I'll just read this. The Washington Post published a story in 2016 titled "Tossed Aside in the White Gold Rush, Indigenous People Are Left Poor as Tech World Takes Lithium from Under Their Feet." It was estimated in the story that Minera Exar would make about $250 million annually from the Cauchari Alaraz mine. Despite this, Minera Exar's contracts with six local communities promised only tiny amounts of money once production had started. For example, while Minera Exar was likely to make $250 million a year from the mine, they would only pay $9,000 to the local town of Catua, $12,000 to Susques, $25,000 to Puesto C and Juancar, $47,000 to Alaraz Chico, and $59,000 to Pastos Chicos. So you can see how corporations extract. That's where I'm talking about capitalism more of in the abstract sense, is that they're making all this money, they're paying pittance, you know, just little bits to the indigenous communities to buy them off. We were talking about that with, like, they want to sell, you know, local jobs. And what, they're not going to be the good jobs or the higher paying jobs, you know. It's just a lie. It's a big lie. And at the end, you know, all the water is poisoned. And then once the water is poisoned, that's where it comes back to Standing Rock. When we say water is life, that's what we mean. Once the water is poisoned, once the water is taken or, you know, complete. Yeah, I mean, like, what we're talking about in Nevada is the sulfuric acid that they're going to need to ship in. And talk about the amount of truckloads that they're going to have to bring from Winnemucca of sulfuric acid into Thacker Pass. I mean, it's just like the pollution, the destruction of a sacred place. It's absolute destruction. I mean, that's, if you destroy a place, you destroy the sacred land. And not to mention the endangered species, you know what I'm saying? So you can see what they've done to indigenous communities in South America, and that's what's going to happen here if this is able to go through.
Now, I see this irony. You all have been involved in fighting Jordan Cove, some people for 17 years. The battle is very, very close to being won. It was easy to vilify a fossil fuel company or the many different fossil fuel companies that took charge of that project over the 17 years, because fossil fuel causes climate change. Fossil fuel is destructive in so many ways, and there seemed to be a very strong link between the destruction of indigenous lands as well as settler lands and the profits of the fossil fuel companies that want to put these pipelines in. We're seeing the same issue with lithium, even though lithium is the sort of the central element in the important renewable energy future that we're all envisioning. So I'm wondering, how do we deal with this? I mean, is there another way to get lithium? Is there something else we should be using instead of lithium? How do we get to a point where we have our whole energy system is sourced on renewable sources of energy? Is there a way that we could get lithium that wouldn't be so destructive?
That's the crux of the whole conversation, right? And it's been really, I'm going to be really honest. I've had a really, really difficult time processing what you're describing in the transition within the movement from fighting LNG, fossil fuel resource extraction, like Jordan Cove LNG projects, to seeing the drastic shift to just pushing 100% renewable energy bills, regardless of what's even written in them, before the writing even happened. And so that was the most concerning part for me, because I'm like, well, we just stopped an LNG pipeline, but yet the state of Oregon wants to include LNG as a renewable energy source. So, you know, I've had behind the scenes, I've been having to fight to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so some of the other things that are not renewable energy are biomass. What did we just witness since last September? Mass wildfires across the entire state. We've all been locked up in a pandemic. What's been happening? Logging, clear cutting. They've been clear cutting all of these trees, and I've been witnessing it right here in Chiloquin. Collier State Park was one of the worst hit state parks, and I've been filming it. They are looting our forests. They're clear cutting. I don't know. That's, and Barbara, maybe that's more of your expertise. I don't know all the details.
Well, actually, I've already done a few shows about the logging that's going on in the north, the northwest part of the state, and I'm going to be doing a couple more shows. I'm actually planning to go down to the Umpqua in a few weeks and see firsthand what's going on there. It's a very big concern. I mean, the other thing I kind of want to throw out right now, since we're kind of talking about apocalypses, we just went through this apocalyptic heat wave, and I don't know anybody in their right mind who wouldn't think about what it's like for Portland to have the highest temperatures in the world for several days running, and that. And that has nothing to do with climate change. I mean, it seems like all of our nasty fossil fuel habits have really come home to bite us. So we're dealing with looking at the real consequences of climate change in a very painful way right now. Though the other thing I just wanted to mention is that there was this incredible breeze that started Monday night. And it was like suddenly the heat broke and this breeze blew through everybody's home. And everybody I've talked to has talked about that breeze. And I see it as the breeze of hope, the breeze of wisdom, the breeze that's going to move us into some kind of more enlightened future, I hope. But I think at the same time, while we're dealing with the need to get off fossil fuel, we also have the need to kind of look at the consequences of lithium mining. And I just kind of want to get a sense of, like, how do we put this all together?
Yeah, and sorry, I kind of went off on like a tangent there with the biomass, but yeah, there's, you know, I just get really, you know, I've been an environmental activist since I graduated from undergrad when I was 21 years old, so I'm going on 20 years of doing this work, but that's the scary thing is, like, what is a sacrifice? And that's why I always come back to just having these conversations from, you know, an anti-capitalist perspective, because within capitalism, there's a for-profit system. And so that's the line, you know, is that there needs to be a profit made. And so, there's no way. We're at late-stage capitalism. What you just described, that is a part of late-stage capitalism, or collapse of the empire, the American empire. And so this is the last grab, right? And so it's just a 100 full, you know, full circle of now neo-colonization and mass resource extraction. They're just trying to grab and loot everything and anything they can, whether that's our forests or whether that's lithium. And if you just allow the billionaires, right, we're at the point I was talking about, the massive distribution of wealth from the billionaires or the predatory class, the oligarchs, and then the rest of us that are left, you know, like having to suffer through the heat waves and then those of us who make it out to the land, you know, they're trying to separate us from our connection with the land. So, I mean, so I guess what I'm trying to talk about is that we have to reduce consumption as the Western, even though we're maybe the poor in the Western, you know, cultures, we still have privileges. And so it's just like they're trying to sell us all that we're all going to, you know, I mean, who's going to get Teslas? Who's going to get all the electric cars? I mean, the future of this is just really, it's not logical. It doesn't make sense. And so I think that's the part. It's like a mental decolonization that needs to happen. And so folks, and that's what I was mentioning when I was an environmental activist knocking on people's doors in Portland for 11 years, I did that work. You know, people were like, well, I don't need to talk to you. I already have my Prius. And so that was just a talking point to get people away from your door. I don't want to have to talk to you. I'm already doing my part. So, you know, that's the conundrum, and nothing's changed. And as being an environmental activist who's knocked on people's doors trying to talk to people about these issues for the last 20 years and nobody wants to talk to me, you know, it gets like I get annoyed. And so when it comes down to the lithium projects and I realized what that destruction of what that capitalist project looks like, it's just, you know, I'm gonna go right back to my childhood and say, no, like, we're Indian people, we're native people, we can live off the land. And when I first went to Thacker Pass, I met Duranda's father, Dalen Hinkey, and they got the biscuit roots and they dug them up for me. And, you know, you have to dig two feet down. And so just that root digging, the roots that are there, I want to bring it back to the land. The biscuit roots, all the flowers. I mean, we're talking, it's an exquisite old growth sagebrush forest lands. And the sage grouse, there are bald eagles that nest and live there. And I've seen the antelopes, you know, that run through, the herds of antelope. It is a powerful, sacred place. And I don't care about people needing a million electric cars or whatever the argument is. This place can't be destroyed, and I will do everything and anything I can to protect this place.
And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Klamath Modoc artist and activist Keila Farrell-Smith and Fort McDermitt Paiute tribal member Duranda Hinkey about controversial lithium mines that are being proposed along the Oregon-Nevada border. Well, one of the things that really bothers me about lithium ion batteries, is that they are made to be not recyclable. I mean, it's so hard to extract the lithium. And so one of the things that I've argued is if you made the batteries so that you could keep extracting the lithium when the batteries go dead, when their lifetime expires, that we wouldn't need to mine so much lithium. I'm wondering if you think that is like a partial answer to the problem.
Perhaps. And let me throw it over to Duranda. I don't know a lot about this part of the conversation of like where we move forward. But like I said, my instinct is to say if it's a part of the capitalist system that's for profit, I mean, look at all of our phones. I mean, they want us to buy a new one every year. So it's the same thing.
What do you think, Duranda?
How I see it is just that another reason why, you know, there's no money in recycling these lithium batteries, you know, like you're saying, once it's dead, it's dead. And so what we see is just this continuous mining of lithium, you know, yeah, it's going to save us this much, you know, carbon emissions. But what are you doing when that lithium battery goes out? You know, it's the same thing with coal. Yeah, it might be into a renewable energy source, but lithium is not renewable, you know, it's still coming out of the ground, something we have to take. And so I think it's kind of a pick your poison, you know, what do you want to do? You know, are we going to, you know, continue with gas, oil, and coal and mining all these things, or the lithium? And I just want to mention that not only is it lithium in these batteries, it's graphite, cobalt, nickel, and that's going to go up 20 to 25 times if lithium goes up by 40 times by 2040. And so we see not only 39 more Thacker Pass lithium mines, we're going to see 20 to 25 more of those other mines too. And so to me, that's not saving the planet, you know, destructing and mining more for these resources that are in the ground. I wish it would just stay in the ground. Like, we need to look at ourselves in the mirror as a society and say, hey, just like Keila is saying, can stop consuming so much, stop having, you know, these new cars every year and these new phones every year. It's like this capitalist like cycle, and it's so sad. And just to think that this is what they put us into, and this is what we're like roboted into, is just keep buying. So yes, lithium powered cars might save you for a little bit, but that is not the solution. We cannot save the planet by keep destroying it, you know. And so we see this like weird balance of what do we do? Man, I really wish.
I want to end on a positive note, guys. So let's think of how can we lead the listeners to go into a place that feels empowering?
I think that's really the million-dollar question, you know, is what do we do? And so I would really like to say, like, hey, this is the solution. But I really think it's time to reflect and you know, start looking at what you can do. I don't really think it's like what you can do. It's like when you think like that, it continues to make you buy. It continues like, oh, I'm going to go and buy, you know, this solar panel to help me. But it's not that. I think it's like a dramatic change within the society. I think that's, you know, really starts with our communities, talking groups, things like that. You know, these nonprofit organizations start questioning people like, hey, are what you doing actually the right thing? How Kaila was talking about the, you know, rogue climate and how they're pushing for renewable energy. And so I just think it's like time to start questioning these ideas.
And how about you, Kaila?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I always want to end on a positive note. And, you know, I'm just, like I said, I've been in this movement for a long time, personally, like on the boots on the ground, like walking, talking. And so, I am getting a little, maybe a little annoyed with folks who like just won't kind of arrive at the reality of the situation that our earth is burning down. And we're running out of time. We've run out of time. Like that's kind of already happened. So, you know, again, I'm like, I don't want to just, and Barbara, hope, I understand it. I voted for Obama when he was on the hope chain, or hope, that was, but I have to remind you that the last evil in Pandora's box is hope. So, you know, like I'm kind of beyond that point of just wanting to hope and then just hope I can buy a renewable car or whatever, electric car, and that's going to like fix everything. I think it really is about community and the communal spirit and about, you know, Duranda, it's so wonderful to meet you in this virtual space. I'd say it's about community, and we have to critique the capitalist system. And my where I'm going is earthships. I think we need to build earthship villages. So I'll end it on that.
Well, Kaila and Duranda, it's wonderful to talk to you. Thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
Yep. Thank you for having us.
We've been talking with Klamath Modoc artist and activist Kaila Farrell-Smith and Fort McDermitt Paiute tribal member Duranda Hickey. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and Cody XLPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Next week, we are rebroadcasting a show we aired in April with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute and Lummi Nation member Jay Julius, celebrating the victories of the Thin Green Line. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music by Robbie Robertson. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get a COVID shot, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.